we are back. We have 2 hours tonight with the remarkable William Tompkins. I don't know where we would be without the contributions of this man. Heroic contributions. He has disclosed material that you can do with what you want, but you can't easily dismiss it. And many people will say, well, where's the proof? I would direct you to the homepage and look at the top or scroll down under guests and look for the data itself. These are PDF files, and they are stunning. This material comes from the early 1950s and alludes back to things in the teens and even before that. Things that have to do with space travel, advanced technology, extraordinary things. I think most of you know Bill Tompkins well enough by now. I don't need to introduce him. He is a man that I think will forever be linked to the term disclosure. That's what we're doing here. Bill is sharing things. He's been given a green light that have never been said before on any media, in print or in an auditory sense. And he's back with us tonight. Look for part 8. If you scroll up to the top of the homepage, open that deep space image, scroll down, and you'll see part 1, part 2. These are PDFs. And come down to part 8 at the bottom, and you will find the latest batch of what have to be above top secret documents that Bill has somehow, and we don't necessarily need to know how, become quite familiar with. In fact, he owns them, so he's been sharing with all of us. Welcome back, William. How are you?
Well, I'm doing real good tonight. Really good, Jeff.
Good. Glad to hear it. Did you get any rain down there in San Diego?
People said that. I guess I walked between the raindrops for a while today. Yes.
They had a big storm.
We needed the big rain.
Yeah, they had a big storm through most of the middle, I guess, two-thirds of the state of California. So hopefully that will make a difference. Unfortunately, a lot of it is carrying radioactive material with it from Fukushima, either through evaporation off the ocean or direct wind currents from the area. But it's small dose, and if people take care of themselves, they can effectively deal with it. Now, the documents you have released, Part 8, which just went up today at Rents, and they'll be looked at by a lot of people. So again, let me just remind you, go to the top right under the name Rents, and look, it says a world first. You'll see a couple of galaxies, and you'll see a yellow click here. That will take you to a page about Bill Tompkins and the material he has shared with us. This Part 8 PDF, the documentation, we'll get to that, I guess, in a little bit, but there are a number of questions that were asked of you or alluded to and never quite answered because we got misdirected into another area of discourse, but I got a list of questions here. You want to go through those first, just for fun?
Oh, that's good, yes.
Right there, and thanks to Frank Chile for sending these along. How much more can Bill Tompkins share regarding his insider work experience that we aren't yet aware of, and what may be forthcoming in subsequent books that we can look forward to? So what areas haven't we spent much, if any, time on, Bill, that you'd like to talk about and illuminate people about?
Okay, if we had time tonight, I'd like to get into the high jump program. I'd like to get into the LA sightings, and I'd also like to get into the blue orbs.
Very good. Well, we can certainly do all that, and we have 2 hours. And but those three, if you'd like, there are orbs. I've reported on them for 23 years. Some are orange, some are white, some are green, some are blue. These orbs can range in size from a ping pong ball to a basketball and even the size of an automobile. What are they, Bill?
Well, gee whiz, I'm going to have to go back to when I was only 7, 8 years old. Okay, uh-huh. We're living in Hollywood. My brother and my cousin and I went to the backyard of my cousin's house, which is a small two-bedroom house in Hollywood. And they didn't have much money. He worked for the railroad company, her father. And so there was no landscaping in the house, and the backyard was just dirt. So
May I say one thing, Bill? Don't lose your train of thought. This is important. Bill Tompkins' father was one of the original heavyweight players in Hollywood motion picture development in the 20s and into the 30s. But in the 20s, his father, and I've looked this up and read quite a bit about it, was he was a giant. It's quite a story. Maybe we can do that at some point in the future, another program. I'd like that. But back to your narrative there. You were just starting to do it, and I interrupted you. But I wanted to honor your father because you said 7 and 8 years of age, and that puts you right in Hollywood at its beginning of its golden era.
Yes. And, I would love to have talk about this on a different program later. I don't want to say why my father didn't have money now, but that's a whole program that we need to talk about.
Sure.
Okay, but anyway, the three of us after school go out in the backyard, his cousin's backyard, and we dig holes, okay? And we dig tunnels, like about a fist, little four-inch tunnels. We dig them down horizontal. We dig them down straight. We dig them down and turn to the side. We dig into another tunnel from the first tunnel, and it's just a lot of fun. So
you're engineering a little maze of tunnels. How fun, like gopher tunnels, but...
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Okay, so...
What are you anticipating, Bill, at the age of 7?
Okay, let's don't get into that. So, actually, my cousin did go into the war, World War II, came back and got his education, and he became one of the top astrophysicists on the planet. But he's digging these holes, okay? So while we're digging the holes, from around the side of the house, on our side of the fence, on his house side of the fence, these guys came in. And they're about 6 inches, 7 inches tall. They look sort of like a rabbit without ears, okay? So these guys come in. They don't pay any attention to us. There's the three of us. There's 7 or 8 of them. Different times there could be only 1 or 2. Other times there could be as many as 10 or 12.
Are these humanoid-looking, walking with arms and legs?
Yes. They look sort of like rabbits without ears.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, they jump, and sometimes they float. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, they are jabbering with each other, not paying any attention to us, and we're not paying any attention to them. This will go on for maybe an hour and a half.
Wow.
They get bored. We get bored with them doing this and interfering with our digging. And so they all look up. They all stand up and look over at us sort of give us a real stare, okay? And then they sort of hit their shoulders, and they all march around the side of the house where they disappear. Wow. Okay.
Were they wearing what we would call clothing? Were they fur covered? Did they have skin? What did they look like?
They had fur.
And, like rabbits. All right.
Like rabbits. And these guys jumped up and down, but they also would move from one area, maybe 6 or 7 feet, by floating. So they didn't run across the dirt.
I got
it. They floated across the dirt.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
So you're talking about orbs. Okay, he called these his sports.
Spell it.
I don't know where that name came from. B-O-R-T-S.
Okay. Sports, all right.
And so I don't know where that name came from, but I have to say that digging holes, and he was an expert at it, our cousin, Then having gotten his doctors in geology and astrophysics and the whole ball of wax, and becoming, I guess, one of the top astrophysicists on the planet, mm-hmm. at least certainly in the United States, he was responsible working for the Shell Oil Company down in Houston to do the whole boring drilling of the continental shelf on the East Coast. And that was his program. And he's the guy that dug the deepest hole in the planet. But with us, and the three of us, we're digging holes in the backyard of his house, his kids. Okay, so I don't know where, the name Bort came
Bort.
From, but that
right.
was Bort. B-O-R-T.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you're talking about orbs, okay? I've recently read a number of different documents about orbs. And now, my understanding is that, and I'm talking to the audience here, okay, that this guy, Jeff something, I can't remember his last name, this guy, Jeff, knows all about orbs, okay? He's been looking at them for years. Now, maybe he can tell us collectively, the audience and me, is a Bort an orb? Now, I think it's time for you, sir, to tell us what you know about orbs. Maybe the blue orbs or the yellow orbs or whatever.
Or the orange orbs or the green orbs. Orbs are seen... and reported on this program and elsewhere, of course, as being sometimes found in haunted houses. They're smallish. Sometimes they'll just travel down a hallway across a room in full view of people. Sometimes they'll be outside. I've had people tell me on this program that they were as large as an automobile and they were floating right down the street in their residential neighborhood. Other times they're sighted... in the sky, and they're orange. Now, this is common, and it's been going on for about 5 years now. Sometimes they'll come from horizon and proceed overhead to the other horizon in long queues of orange orbs, 20, 30. One law enforcement officer retired, and I've forgotten which state, perhaps New Mexico or Arizona, said he counted over 100 coming in groups, small groups, from one horizon, same trajectory to the other horizon. So we have a whole wide array of these orbs, Bill, and there's no definitive way to diagnose them, what they're doing, who they are, what they are, except that they are clearly under some kind of intelligence and intelligent control. Maybe they're doing reconnaissance. Maybe they're surveilling us. We don't know. Maybe they just live here on the planet, another life form, like Trevor James Constable found out in the 1950s with infrared film, things in the sky that we can't see but are quite apparent in the film. So it's a strange world we live in and a strange universe. So that's my general simplistic overview of orbs.
Well, did anybody call the police to capture one?
Oh, that last thing you want to do is call the police. I don't think they want anything to do with orbs.
Okay, all right.
So we had a couple of women on the program, maybe 2 years ago, three. They were camping in a Washington state, I think, or along the Columbia River. And they were looking up and seeing these orbs, and there were groups of them just moving overhead, orange. But the predominant color of those that are airborne is orange. Some people call them fireballs, but they're not really fire. This is the color. It's red-orange.
Okay, sounds good to me. There's got to be a relationship between orange and orbs.
Well, I'm going to call the cops and find out.
Okay, cool deal. Could we go to high jump or maybe...
High jump is always fascinating, and I just looked at another video which purports to, and I haven't seen it, I just looked at the beginning of it. It purports to talk about Germany in the Antarctic before, during, and after World War II. So by all means, let's load up and jump on Operation High Jump and go on down there with Admiral Byrd and see what you have to say.
Okay, yes, you said Admiral Byrd. Also, there was the number one Navy admiral that was with the Byrd when it went down. This was a planned program before the war was over. And we actually didn't win the war, but the war stopped. And we had a lot of people come over from Germany and sort of help us out with NASA. But as a separate program, which had been going on for over a year before the war ended, there was a lot of information about different German operations having been moved from Germany to Antarctica.
Now, this would have been in the 30s and 40s, I assume.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. And so there were actually very large facilities in caverns underneath the ground there in Antarctica. And some of these very large ones were controlled and as operating station or facilities for the extraterrestrials, that would have been the reptilians, and I guess the Dracos too. And
Bill, is there any truth to the idea that there were three large bases down there or more, and one of them wasn't really being used by the reptilians, and they gave that to the Germans, so the Germans didn't have to go down there and drill under the ice and build these enormous cavern cities down there. They were allowed usage of one that was already in existence. Is that a viable thesis?
Yes, actually, the Dracos had two very large ones and enormous cities, enormous research centers, and all types of stuff going on. And this was a smaller one, so yeah, they gave it to Hitler and the SS. And so they encouraged the SS to do much of their research on attempting to build different classes of military UFOs that the Dracos and the reptilian navies had.
Right.
And so before the war started and during the war and before it stopped, they had actually moved tremendous numbers of complete factories to in-ground factories in mountains. All over Germany and some of the occupied countries, take these factories and all of the slave labor and put them on these special large submarines and transport them down to Antarctica.
So they didn't use surface ships. They put these in, they must have been huge submarines, but we know all the basic types of subs that the Germans had. Did they use any transport ships before the war broke out in 38, 39?
They did use some, and they also went to South America, too.
Sure.
And they had some facilities they were working with there underground.
Mm-hmm.
And not ones that they had to drill, but ones that were already there. So they had a very large program. By the last year of the war, to move essentially probably 70 to 75% of all of the military programs related to extraterrestrial vehicles and everything that's required for these. So different classes of German naval space programs were moved to Antarctica. So the U.S. knew all about this. They knew it took place, and they knew they were doing this. And essentially, if you stopped the war, you had essentially no control over all of the SS and their facilities that they had moved out of Germany before we bombed it to where it couldn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd moved this to Antarctica. So now our military, our Navy, mm-hmm. then had the problem of how do we stop these Nazis down there in Antarctica. So they put together this Navy battle group, which had, I think, over 40 aircraft. They used very large PV patrol bombers that flew to the other side of Antarctica. And essentially, they were going to attack the Antarctica mainland from two different sides at the same time and simply stop this. If they have to bomb them out, they'll bomb them out.
How were they going to bomb them out in 1947? We didn't have nuclear blockbusters then, and these are under enormous mountains and capped with enormous amounts of ice. And you mentioned PBYs, I think, coming from one side. They didn't have a really large payload, so I'm not sure if bombing them would have been much more than a harassment activity.
Well, it actually was a harassment activity to get them out. Okay, because you just defined their problem, our American Navy battle group problem. You have to get them out. So there was a whole program with this to set up their supplies, to stop their supplies and all these things.
Right.
They had no idea the magnitude that the extraterrestrial facilities were down there. They didn't even know that there were extraterrestrial caverns that were much larger than the Germans. We were only aware that the Germans were down there underneath the ground, under the ice. Actually, the German, our naval intelligence found that the Germans would enter and leave their facilities in the underground caverns in, I think, four different tunnels. So going by submarine, which is one of the reasons most of the personnel and the equipment were taken aboard submarines, very large ones, and they would stay submerged, go into a tunnel, which then would open up inside the cavern.
Mm-hmm.
And there's docks there, and there's facilities for them. And they had a big construction program, which was assisted by the aliens, and to set up essentially to live in a large cavern in Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
And so U.S. Navy was given the job to go down and take them out. Now, before they got down there, before they actually started antagonizing with different approaches to the Germans, many German UFOs came out of both the Atlantic and the Pacific side and shot down every airplane and helicopter that we had. And so all the planes off of the carrier were shot down too, not just the big PBYs and PBMs. PBM was a Martin gull wing.
That was the big Martin flying boat. That was a huge plane, too, yeah.
Yeah, an enormous plane. Mm-hmm. And these were all shot down in the first day of the activities.
Now, the Navy, as you know, if you look up the official history, which means cover-up, of Operation High Jump, they claim they lost two planes, and they didn't really disclose how or why. They've never dismissed the conjecture of anyone. They just ignore it. That they lost all their planes, or most of their planes. Everything they put up was knocked down.
Yes. And in just a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
Then they sank, I'm not certain of the number, but roughly a quarter of the battle group were sunk.
Wow.
And this all happened very quickly. And so, obviously...
were you still, Bill, were you still in the Navy in 47? How did you find out that the actual losses, which you're reporting to us tonight, were as big and as extensive as you're disclosing here? Because they keep this covered up.
Yeah, I'm only saying that this is quite common knowledge in the group that I was with.
Uh-huh.
Because essentially, we were providing information, which is part of the Navy operatives, our spies, got back from Germany about the extraterrestrial support that Germany was getting.
Right.
So we then are contacting all of the... They didn't have aerospace companies, and they just had aircraft factories. And then all of the advanced medical research organizations, like Scripps and these others, from the medical side. So we took these packages. I flew the packages to every one of these facilities all over the United States. So we are communicating them with them. So some of them then are aware of what's taking place with the battle group. And so there's all kinds of questions that are being addressed in the classified Navy program on this battle group that went down there, because a great deal of effort was put together to build a separate last Navy battle group after the war was almost over.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people were involved in this. And so when essentially the that first day where almost everything was taken out, the ships, the Navy ships moved away from Antarctica, and the decision was made almost immediately, even though it wasn't accepted in Washington, in the Pentagon, but it was, decision was made immediately aboard the battle group command ship, that there's no way we could counter what was taking place, because there were some sort of strange, what they called laser weapons that were being used that nobody had any understanding about.
Laser beam weapons of some kind, right? I've read.
Yes, and so nobody had any information on that except the Navy operatives under command of Admiral Riccobata, because they brought back information about what the Germans had and were working on developing copies of extraterrestrial laser-type weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So these were immediately put together that, the Navy itself disseminated some of this information that was brought back by the Navy operatives and to all of the top Navy organizations in communications and weapons and virtually everything. It wasn't just given as contracts to the American aircraft companies and the American research people in the medical side. So this was an immediate loss of a battle. And it was a one-sided battle.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually nothing that we had came anywhere near.
No effectiveness at all. I got it.
Yeah. And so immediately... the information which the operatives had been bringing back, during the last part of the war, these two things were put together. Mm-hmm. And the Secretary of the Navy said, get out of there. But that was a one-sided argument. And we did lose a lot of personnel.
Well, if people look up the formal story, don't expect to hear or read anything like this. There are many videos on the internet talking about what purportedly happened in Antarctica, which are certainly paralleling what Bill is telling us now. You got to be real careful with this information, though. There's a lot of temptation among people just to make things up or to quote sources that are not verifiable, and it gets out of control. But if Bill is telling us that these losses were as large as they were, this had to have sent a message that lasted for many years. Now in Antarctica, the United States basically treats most of the continent as if it's its own private property. There are areas that you can't fly over, no fly zones. Apparently Google Earth has put in other video imagery anyway over certain areas that are considered or have been considered top secret. There's a lot going on in Antarctica, and I mean LOT, a lot that we have no idea about. This is an enormous continent, and apparently under the ice are relics and the remains of ancient civilizations and other things, if you can believe what you hear. But there's a lot of romanticizing of what's under the ice in the Antarctic. But we do know the Germans were down there. We do know that they put some films out in the movie theaters for German citizens to see in 38, 39, 40. But they don't tell what they really were doing down there. They make it look like it was a simple expedition. Obviously, much more was going on. And now you're saying that in 1947, as we know, high jump was a failure. In 1952, fast forward, what happened in Washington, D.C.? What overflew the White House? A large formation of unidentified flying objects which look like lights in the sky at night. And there might have been a couple, three dozen of them. And from what Bill tells us, those were in fact Germans flying German craft from the Antarctic.
Yes. Wow.
All right. You want to go? Let's go on to, there's some really interesting questions here. Let's pop to the next one. Did the visitors, go ahead, Bill. What? Did you have something else you want to add? Go ahead, please.
No. I just would like to get into the Los Angeles sighting thing, if we could.
We will. Let's do it right now. This is February 21st, I believe, 1942. I forget the exact date. It's called the Battle of Los Angeles. It may have been the largest mass UFO sighting in American history. At least one, perhaps two craft of ET nature and origin were brought down during that operation, which was really capped off with hours of anti-aircraft fire, 4,000 rounds plus, and then aircraft that we had sent to try to shoot them down as well. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. I want to set the stage for that as far as I'm concerned, because what has been published about this event, I have to say, is not the real story at all. Okay. Now, my dad was in different businesses, and so he would jump from one thing to the other. And so he had an office. We had been living in Hollywood, and then we lived in Santa Ana for a short time, and then we lived in Long Beach. And we did that twice, and so this is the second time we were living in Long Beach. And now the year is 1950, and 1942, I'm sorry. And we're living in a very large our family in a very large home that had been rebuilt into four separate apartments. Our apartment was on the second floor. So this big home had very high ceilings, particularly on the lower floors. So actually our apartment was like the third floor of this great big house in a really nice neighborhood, old in Long Beach. But this, of course, a rented house. So
this is February 1942. All right.
Yeah. And so my dad called my brother and I to come out on the back deck. But they had an enormous deck that ran all the way across the back of this great big house at the second floor level. So we're about a little over four blocks from the beach. And there's a Palisades there. So you go down from the Palisades to get to the beach to go up, to go bathing. But so we can see the tops of houses from this back porch. It's real high. And we can see the trees and everything. And so my dad, around 7 o'clock, saw this light, which was just above the horizon of the trees and the roofs of the houses. And we were looking at it. My brother and my dad and I, my mom was back east and at that time. And so a small beam of light came out of this facing south, but at about a 30-degree angle down towards, we thought, would be the ocean, because we didn't know how far out it was. We watched this little light. It didn't move. It just focused. It came out facing down towards the ocean. And we watched it for about 8 or 10 seconds, and it turned and faced us. And as it faced us, everything got lit up on the back of that great big house, all of the trees around us, the other roofs and everything. It was like a bright, lighter than the sun in the middle of the day. I mean, it's 7 o'clock at night. Okay.
It would have been dark,
and
yeah.
So we watched this thing for another 8 to 10 seconds, and it goes out. Okay, we're a little bit blinded, but we eat dinner early, and surprisingly, we go to bed early. So sometime after, like, 1:45 or something like that at night, the anti-aircraft guns all go off, and they start firing. So we get out of bed, we get dressed real quick, we go downstairs, and we get with all of the other people up and down the street that are out in the street, the sidewalks, looking up at some vehicles that were slowly passing from the ocean east towards what would be, I guess, Mount Wilson's mountain range.
So they were coming in off of the ocean, not coming from the northeast, moving southwest at that time. They were coming in from the ocean. Different.
They were coming in from the ocean, heading almost east. Okay? And they were different shaped vehicles. Some of them were larger than the others.
How could you determine that, Bill? It's dark. Now, are they lit up? Do they have luminescence of some kind? Or can you see them from the city lights reflecting on them? Were they down low? Or were they up high?
They were like at about 8,000 feet up.
Right.
And by this time, I had, this is, of course, after the war. And so I had gotten my single-engine pilot's license. And I actually qualified for commercial. But so I flew, like I've said in that book that I put out there, that I flew almost every type of airplane that the Navy had, so I know I can judge heights of vehicles, airplanes, or whatever, and pretty good. So this is now three or four vehicles flying very slow with no noise. And they're just like spots. But when this big one comes in, which at arm's length, you can do this right now, everybody in the audience. Just take your arm, put it out in front of you, maybe a little bit high, spread your thumb and the first finger, okay? Get it to where it's about 3.5 or 4 inches. That's how big this thing was that came in with all these searchlights, which has been going up, some spotting the smaller ones and following the smaller ones across the sky.
So these are our military searchlights that were up high enough, and they were actually illuminating these craft.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so the anti-aircraft guns were shooting these smaller vehicles. And, of course, you could see explosions on some of these smaller vehicles, which we thought, you know, they're going to crash. They're going to come down and crash.
Right.
And they didn't. So when this big one moved in, our particular area in Long Beach is close to the Coast Artillery, which was doing the firings. But we didn't know it at the time, and I found out later that every ship that was anchored was firing at these two. So you've been told that the Coast Artillery used up all of their ammunition that night. You weren't told that not only the active ships that were tied up inside the breakwater were shooting at these, but the ships that were in dry dock under construction, their crews or emergencies that stayed on board, were firing from the ships that were in dry dock.
Right, I got it.
Because they still had the ammunition. Huh. And they still had some of the personnel available.
Uh-huh.
And they used up all of their ammunition, both the dry dock people and the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which was tied up inside
We don't have an accurate count of the total number of rounds that were fired. It might have been much more than the reported numbers.
It was 10 times what was reported.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And so here's the big problem. This went on with this vehicle that parked for 2.5 hours.
That long.
It's there.
There are pictures of it up there, and all the searchlights had it nailed, and there were bursts going off all around it. This big. I told you I have a friend, or she's passed on now, who was an air raid warden who told me the whole story. That craft was parked pretty much above her home at the time, and she watched the whole thing.
Was she in Long Beach too?
Culver City.
Okay, so we're talking about more than one large one. That's interesting.
Yeah, the big one over Culver City came from the northeast, moving southwest. That was one, and that's the famous picture you can find if you look. Do a search for Battle of Los Angeles, and you'll find a picture of clearly an object up there in the night sky with about 10 searchlights just pasted on it, and then you can see white round dots around it, and those are anti-aircraft shells exploding.
Exploding, yeah. Okay. Let me go on here, Jeff. I have to get my part to this. Okay. So we're all outside watching this, and we can't believe this thing doesn't crash down over Long Beach.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't. And so finally, it slowly moves off. Now, while we watched it for 2.5 hours, okay, now it's 3 o'clock or something, and other vehicles came in on the north side of it, other vehicles came in on the south side, moving slow past it. Some of the anti-aircrafts that were concentrating on the big vehicle went to these others, particularly the larger of the smaller vehicles, because we established roughly 4 different classes and possibly a 5th class, very small. And so this went on till we got bored. And my dad and my mom, my brother and I went to bed, and we slept through the anti-aircraft continuing to fire.
Uh-huh.
So sometime around 4:30 or 5, the anti-aircraft stopped, and we talked to the neighbors the next morning, who many of them, I would say at least 30 to 40 of the people up and down that street, my dad talked to all of them, and they stayed up all night long and watched this continuous operation of many, many different types of big and small UFOs coming from the ocean and going east towards Mount Wolf. Now, I have to say, if you can picture this situation. Now, Jeff, you talked about another large one in a different part of L.A., okay?
Well, that large one, allegedly, Bill, moved over Culver City. It would have been southwest toward Long Beach and ended up over Long Beach several hours later.
Okay.
Maybe an hour later, I guess. It was moving, but not very fast. It wasn't completely parked for the entire time that she saw it. But she said it was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen.
Okay. We saw numerous different types of vehicles.
Can you describe the shapes?
There were cigar-shaped. There were sort of round type, but we didn't realize that that was a saucer because we're looking at the bottom of it. We thought it was a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And there were rectangular. And there were different sizes of these. And so from a standpoint of identifying aircraft, you pretty well, if you've been a pilot in the Navy, you pretty well can look at an aircraft and see the general shape of it, even if there's just light reflecting off of this massive thing that's parked there as these others come by.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the searchlights went off of this big thing and went to the ones that were slowly passing south of it or north of it. A couple of them came right almost underneath it, but just on the side, and the anti-aircraft left the big one because it had been firing at it and followed that one till it was out of sight going east. Now, what I want to picture here is there's only two ways that this thing could have happened, this mission. One, that all of the vehicles were coming off of the ocean and heading west of the ones we saw. So they would have had to pass over Mount Wilson Range.
Right.
Gone east of that, turned south, gone down east of San Diego, come over San Diego, going west now, out over the ocean, making another 180, turning north, turning back in towards the beach, and flew through again, so that you could say there were dozens and dozens and dozens of vehicles, different types. None of them as big as the big one that we saw, but some of the others were quite large. And that this is what was happening. They were making a circle, making us think there were hundreds and hundreds of vehicles. Or maybe there were dozens and dozens and dozens and maybe 200 vehicles that came from out in the Pacific Ocean and flew over Long Beach, over Pasadena, and then went somewhere else. So you have to ask the question, because the sightings that I have talked to, and I want to make a very important point here. At the same time this was taking place on the other side of the planet, the German Air Force was bombing London. And those people were running for any kind of underground coverage they could get to keep from being killed from bombs. Nobody that we saw or talked to that night ever got scared. Nobody was scared. Nobody was nervous. Nobody ran for some sort of coverage because everybody had been mind controlled before this took place.
How
maybe
interesting.
A half a million people in Southern California were mind controlled. We accepted this. It didn't bother us. We never got scared.
Huh.
Like us, we got bored and went to sleep, believe
maybe,
it or not.
Maybe you were the only ones that did.
Well, I'm trying to say that different people had different mind control.
Yeah. Well, you saw the early, well, whatever it was, a craft with a beam of light that really triggered the whole evening's events.
For at least
for you.
The three of us.
That's right.
Yeah, for the three of us. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hold on, Bill. I've got to take a break. We'll come right back.
Okay.
And continue.
All right.
Right after this.